Thank you very much to the children's choir. I'm not used to sitting up front. I'm much more comfortable back behind the soundboard or somewhere at the back of the room. But, hey, it's nice to be up front and watch them perform. See, I've never had anybody pray for me so much as Ben Light's been praying for me. So yesterday he keeps coming around and he's like, are you okay? And then he comes around again, and I finally said, you know, Ben, why don't you just anoint me or something before I even, you know, make sure this thing really works out here today. So, you know, Ben's got enough to do, and it's kind of a setup, you know, when I kind of get this call from, like, the feast coordinator's wife. Like, call Ben. And so I call back, I can't lie to somebody if I'm just making up a story. So I revert back in my mind to when I'm 14 or 15 years old and I crashed my bike. And I said, I crashed my bike. And I'm going through all this sob story. And Ben's like, oh. And he doesn't. Ben's a great guy to pick on. And he'll get me back, I'm sure. When you, I'd like to say hello to those on Cybercast. We're used to doing Cybercast back in Spokane, and fortunately I've been able to meet some of the people that we talked to on Cybercast from Eureka and Claire Williamson down in Elko, Nevada. Just nice to get to know some of you that watch us from time to time. There are the Salmons over there. They're always watching us. And so when you think of the millennium, what's one of the first images that pops into your head? Lion and the lamb. Very good. You know, there's the image of the leopard and the bear and the little child leading them. That's going to be an awesome scene. And I don't know if the mothers are going to be real into this right away. I Googled what leopard sounds like and what lion's roars. And I was going to have these audio guys, you know, play some lion and leopard and whatever sounds. And they're all roars. There's nothing tame about a leopard. And I can just imagine this millennial scene of the leopard coming onto the back porch and, you know, roar. And the mom's going, oh, it's just Billy Bob or something, and just my little Amy out there playing in the backyard, no big deal. All right, so you have this millennial scene, Lion and the Lamb. I'm an electrical contractor. We work in construction as much as possible this economic, this wonderful time we live through. When we do a remodel project, it's quite common that people take before and after pictures. You know, the old kitchen, you know, the old sink, the old counter. Then at the end of the project, you have the new and improved, the old master bedroom suite, and now the new master bedroom suite. Extreme Makeover Home Edition is a good example of this that many of you can relate to, where they show the little old rotten house and they come in and blow the thing up and kind of wipe it off the map, and then they build a new one and a week or something. That's a great example of how it was and how it is. And the Lion and the Lamb is a great example also, because you can think about how it is now or how it's going to be after all the devastation. Then you think of Lion and the Lamb. Well, that's before and after. Before and after. But just like it takes an incredible amount of work to go from the remodel, the before shots to the after shots, many times you don't think about all the blood, sweat, and tears that went on in the middle of that little effort. And there will be a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that go on between now and the time that the lion and the lamb are wandering around and with the little child leading them. So it's going to take a lot of effort to get to a society where people have a lovely environment, and you have decent people. At the beginning of a project, you see yourself, oh, if I could just have this new kitchen or this new master bedroom, and then you see the end of the project, in the middle of that project, there's a lot of work to be done. And there's going to be a lot of work to be done as we go into the millennium and work through in the millennium. It's not going to be a piece of cake or a joy walk. A lot of work to go on in between. Does anyone know anybody that started a remodel project or a housing project or restoring that old car? That's what people like to do. They restore cars for like 50 years. Yes. Do you know anybody that's ever finished one? Oh, two people. Well, God started a project and he is going to finish it, and he's not constrained by time or money, which is one of our problems these days. But it's a process. It's a process that's going to take time. God isn't going to hand out a bottle of righteousness pills or peace pills, and it's not something that's just going to, like, you know, plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. It's going to take a lot of work, and there's quite a process that's going to go on. Isaiah 26, this was touched on the other day, but hey, it's the feast, and it's my turn. So Isaiah 26 and verse 9 says, "With my soul I have desired you in the night. Yes, by my spirit within me I seek you early. For when your judgments are in the earth, when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness." It's not a peace pill or a righteousness pill. People have to learn. A couple chapters later in 29 verse 24, it says, "Those who complained will learn doctrine." They have to learn doctrine. So when the millennium starts, the world is going to be a mess. At the beginning of the millennium, people will be war ravaged, disease infested. You'll have survivors of the seven seals, seven last plagues, and all the other drama and horror that's gone on. People will actually, at some point, they're going to have to find their families. How can you, like, think of the families today? I had brother in California, brother in Oklahoma, and sister in Texas. And if I had to go find those people right now without the modern means of communication and transportation, I might never see them again because it takes so long to get there. And while I'm going to try to find them in a disaster, they might be trying to come find me. And then, well, how about my wife's family? And you, in a natural disaster or where we had a major trauma, it would be very, very difficult to get reunited. So just imagine the world with all the trauma that's gone on, and you're going to try to reunite with your family. So it's going to be quite interesting. I see that there won't be any GPS system for mothers to keep track of their kids. They're not going to have little cell phones with GPS tracking on them. I see it as kind of a like this huge train wreck on a global scale, third world planet. I see that it's going to be very quiet, and at night it's going to be very dark. And I don't think industry will be thriving, and I don't think there will be any new cars at the car lot. And I think smartphones will be dumb. And I don't think anybody's going to be saying, "Oh boy, the kingdom of God is here. Let's party." Because it's going to be pretty miserable for a lot of people in the beginning. The hope and expectation is that people will get back together, that that God's going to provide some help for these people to restore and reunite their families. And they're going to have to be willing to be guided and be willing to submit. But God's going to place leaders there to take care of that. But how long will it take to have decent families? Okay, so the families get reunited. How long is it going to take to have a decent family? Let's assume families do get together and they do propagate. Soon their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. Life should be good, right? How long will it take to have a decent family? Remember, there's no righteousness pill, no peace pill, no instantaneous anything. Well, if we use the formula that today we're fighting Satan, society, and self, if you get rid of the Satan factor, it kind of still leaves society and self to fight. Without Satan there as the catalyst for causing and, you know, working on our minds and presenting all the indecent opportunities that abound, we still are going to have to fight society, other people, ourselves. We're still going to, there's not we, hopefully we in loose terms are going to be spirit beings, and we're going to be there as a solution. But let's turn to 1 John 2 and verse 15. 1 John 2, verse 15. Again, God's in control. God knows what's going on. He's got solutions. He's got people in place. He's got a plan, and he's going to fulfill that plan. 1 John 2:15. But we still have these things that humans have to fight. 1 John 2:15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, what's in the world? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. It doesn't even say that it's of Satan. It says it's of the world. So we, the people that are living at that time, are going to have to fight these things, and they're going to have to overcome. And the world is passing away and the lust of it, but he who does the will of the Father abides forever. And those people are going to have to do the will of the Father as well. So Satan right now flaunts these things in our face. But when Satan is out of the picture, these things don't just go away. He is like the accelerant in a fire. He's the gasoline. He is the TNT. He's the one that causes a lot of problems, even if we can't think of it ourselves. It's like back in the Garden of Eden. Eve might have been doing okay until the serpent comes along and plants these ideas. And at that point, she starts running with them, doesn't she? So at that point, he's planted the ideas and she's going, yeah, that is pretty good. I don't disagree with it. I think there's a better way out there. So at that point, the serpent can sit back and go, ha, 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 look at that. I've got you again. The serpent does the sales job, but Eve bought into it. She heard what she wanted. She heard it. She wanted it. She ran with it. So learning God's way will be a process, much like we go through today, I think, except without the devil there stirring the pot. Isaiah 30, verse 19, the people of the millennium will have a little help. Isaiah 30 and verse 19. Isaiah 30, verse 19. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. You will be very gracious. He will be very gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. Verse 20. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. Anymore means that there's been a period of time where the teachers are in the corner. I don't feel like I'm out front. I feel like many times I'm in the corner. So I can do my thing. I can perform righteous acts. I can affect a small group of people around me. But in general, the ways of God and the people of God are not out in the forefront of what's going on in society. So your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. But your eyes shall see your teachers. So it's going to be a hands-on environment. It sounds like people are going to be doing things and they're maybe going to go off course and someone's going to be right there. Because look at the next verse. He says, your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Like, no, don't do that. Get that thought out of your mind. That doesn't belong there. Whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. It doesn't say that people are going to, when this happens, that people are going to say, oh, what a great idea. I'm so glad you're here. They're still going to have free will. They're still going to want to do what they want to do. Satan's out of the picture, but still people are going to have to learn and grow and have and develop the character just like we do. Who are those teachers? Who are those people showing them? Hopefully that's us, and hopefully we've learned our lessons today, and we can say to them, look, you know, here, sit down here on this rock, and let me tell you, back when 2012, and this particular thing happened. And so they can tell the stories and relate what happened in this day and age to what's going to happen there. But how long will it take to have decent families? We know the environment, you know, the teachers are going to be there. God's going to be in righteous command. It's God's government. But how long will it take to have decent families? One way to demonstrate this to you is to explain the history of my family, because I don't think my family is altogether different than many of the families in this world. Many of you know I'm a second generation, 54 years old, and this is my 55th Feast of Tabernacles. Because when I was 4 months old, I went to my first Feast of Tabernacles. I didn't get much out of it. I slept a lot. So here with us today, I have there are three third generationers sitting in the audience. My mother's in Texas, keeping the feast with my older brother. Let me share a bit of a timeline with you. And I'm going to tell this story based on personal knowledge. You know, some things get handed down in families. I don't know what it would be like in the Coles family where they have so many. They have a lot of cross checks and like, no, that didn't happen that way at all. I remember back. But there aren't so many of us in our family. So I tell the story based on personal information, what was related to me, what my brother remembers, what my mother remembers. And I tell it not to spotlight my family, but to help you think about and help illustrate the kind of people that you're going to have to deal with in the world tomorrow. And the kind of baggage that people are going to be carrying and the kind of things that you're going to have to work with and try to eliminate. So my grandmother, my dad's mother, died when dad was an infant. He had no memory of her. My grandfather remarried. And all the things I've heard about his stepmother, I've never heard a good word about her in any way. It was a blended family. She brought a son from a prior relationship. He was a little bit younger than my dad. I believe his name was George, and he was always in trouble. Dad had a sister. Somehow she became the favorite of the stepmother. So right away there was jealousy and hostility, and hatred was rampant in the family. One of the stories that I remember is that the half-brother, my dad's half-brother, joined the military, and my grandfather, I assume presumably probably with the family, was taking him to the train station to get shipped off to whichever war it was, or to boot camp or whatever. And on the way, my grandfather stopped and bought a watermelon. Now, I don't know, okay, whatever, they must have had watermelons for sale or something. So the question was, and they're on their way to the train station to let this brother go to the military. On the way to the train station, they stop and buy the watermelon. And the question is, when are we going to eat the watermelon? We got the watermelon. It's like a big prize. It's like ice cream today. But no, they had watermelon. When are we going to eat it? Well, they were not going to eat this watermelon until after the brother had gone on the train and gone on his way. They did not want to share even a stupid watermelon with the brother. It's like you got to be kidding me. There's so much hatred in the family. They won't even share a watermelon. So half-brother's gone, then they eat the watermelon. So prejudice, bias, favoritism within the family. But my granddad, he was a manly man. He could drive nails with a six gun. So the way I understand it, my father always got the short end of the stick wherever possible. He got the leftovers. His stepmother had a pure hatred of my father. Pure hatred. I remember him telling of her throwing a butcher knife at him and it hitting him in the chest, handle first. Which Took them a while to get used to. So he wakes up one morning. She's poured lye in his eyes while he was sleeping. Lye is an alkaline solution that's used to make soap and drain and oven cleaners. She set the house on fire. She would shoot at him when he was out working the field. And fortunately, she was a bad shot. When my father went to the military, probably to get away from home, his father sold his sawmill business and pocketed the money, which he didn't appreciate either. The story was that his stepmother was so messed up that it was openly discussed that my grandfather wanted to take her for a drive on a mountain road and throw her over the edge. But he was afraid if he did, he wouldn't go to heaven. So he didn't ever do it. Murder in his heart. My father grew up not capable, had no concept of what family love should be like. It would not compute. He had never experienced it. He had no idea what family love was. And when you look around the world today and you think about the people that are in this world and the evil and the hatred that's been taught from generation to generation over in the Middle East and spread around the world and the evil and the heartbreak that people live through, those are the situations that we're going to have to deal with in the millennium. After my parents were married in 1952, my dad was working with a man who kept telling him he needed to listen to Herbert Armstrong. He did and liked what he heard, and he made my mother sit in the living room and listen to it also. She said she sat there with her arms folded and said, "Fine, I'll listen." But the Sabbath really caught his attention. Apparently, when he was young, he would go to Sunday school, but it never made sense to him why he was in Sunday school and they said the Sabbath was on Saturday. So when he heard someone on the radio saying that Sabbath was the seventh day, it made a lot of sense to him. My dad was baptized, and this always amused me. My dad was baptized with a pack of cigarettes in his pocket. But when they left the Snake River there in Idaho and they headed home, he threw the cigarettes out the window, littering. And that was it. Mom says she doesn't recall him smoking ever after that. He came out of darkness into God's truth, and he never looked back. And he put his heart and soul into obedience to God and keeping the Sabbath and trying to live God's ways. And as kids, we didn't appreciate many of the things that he brought to family life. If you can imagine going from a childhood that he grew up in and then realizing that you're not supposed to throw knives at your kids and you really shouldn't shoot at them. He's trying to make this transition, which makes sense, but he still has the baggage from what he grew up with. So we didn't always appreciate everything that he tried to do for us, and he had no experience in doing it right. He was starting from scratch. How could he teach what he didn't know? But he was trying. He had God's word. He had to learn what godly love looked like. And then he had to try to not revert back to his childhood experiences and all he knew. And I don't know, the cussing and the swearing, you know, all the things that you could just imagine. We can understand why it would be so difficult. And frankly, it was frustrating growing up in that environment because we knew, like, even though as hard as he tried to do it right, when it didn't go well, yes, it was his fault, but he was doing the best he could with what he had. So in theory, when I look back on it and I, you know, older now, I can realize what was going on. I've learned a lot about parental love and family love. He taught me some of it, but I've experienced it in various other ways. And our kids have learned a lot more about parental love and family love than I can teach them, and way more than my father could have ever taught them. They've learned what it's like to live in a loving family and to have a loving congregation. And they go to camps and they learn how to live God's way. And it's not difficult. They didn't come into this situation with all the baggage that my father came into it, or with the aftermath that I came into it with. They have a much better and much easier upbringing. So the difference between what my kids are going through and what my father went through is not even on the same scale. My upbringing is so much better than his, it's not even on the same scale. But it's taking generations to undo the pain that was caused 50, 75 years ago, whatever it was. It's taking generations to undo that. Turn to Exodus 20. This is a scripture that you probably have thought about. I remember when I was memorizing scripture as a child, I read this and it always struck me that, well, let's read it. Exodus 20 and verse 4. Exodus 20 and verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Here's the part I'm trying to get to. I am the Lord your God, I'm a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations. And I see that the iniquity that my father was taught is taking three or four generations to get worked out. To the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. So as the transition is made from hatred and evil and Satan's world, it's going to take some generations to get rid of that evil and get set up to have this loving, but showing mercy to the thousands who love me and keep my commandments. In the NIV, it says, verse 6, it says, but showing love to a thousand generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So God is just and fair, but he's far more forgiving. He's far more apt to be forgiving than he is to be a cursing type of individual or being. So third or fourth generation is a lot different than a thousand generations of God's love. So it's going to take a few generations to get the weeds out, to get rid of the evil. And, I see it as parents realize that their parents have a problem, but at some point they learn too late that, oh, I've got that problem too. And so we're always trying to, as parents and kids, we're trying to figure out what we're supposed to get rid of and how do we change these things that I recognize that my parents didn't do everything right. So now I've got to change that. And, oh, by the way, my kids have already learned part of that bad habit. So we've got to work these things out. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and Joseph are a great example of how God worked with people and he blessed based on obedience. Psalms 105 is a good summary of it. Psalms 105. Psalms 105 and verse 7. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are all in the earth. He remembers his covenant forever. So God remembers. He's going to remember his covenant. The word which he commanded for a thousand generations. The covenant which he made with Abraham and his oath to Isaac. And confirming it to Jacob for a statute. To Israel as an everlasting covenant. Saying to you, I will give the land of Canaan as an allotment for your inheritance. When there were few in numbers, indeed very few and strangers in it. So God is going to remember his promises. We don't have to worry about God not following through on what he said he's going to do. And because of Jesus Christ's sacrifice, he doesn't hold the parents. And I am reaping. I still have some carryovers from what my grandfather and whatever what they practiced and what they taught. But I'm not bound. I'm not trapped by their sin. I can make changes. Jesus Christ's sacrifice allows me to move on. I don't have to relive and redo everything that I was taught or that my father was taught. So it's up to succeeding generations, generation by generation, to fix and to make those things better. So just as we should be making generational improvements, as my father did and as I intend to, as I hope and pray my kids do, we are going to have to help those in the millennium make generational improvements. If these people are willing to submit and obey, and God is willing to forgive them and apply the blood of Jesus Christ to them, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. God will forgive, and he will allow them to go on and make generational improvements. Psalms 112 and verse 3, we're not very far from that. Psalms 112 and verse 1, Psalms 112 verse 1 says, "Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who delights greatly in his commandments. His descendants will be mighty on earth. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches will be in his house, and his righteousness endures forever." Verse 2 in the New Living says, "Their children will be successful everywhere. An entire generation of godly people will be blessed." So as righteous parents produce righteous kids, if the kids will take it and continue and make improvements, this can go on and on. And 1,000 years, this millennial 1,000 years, can be a very rewarding and enriching time. So to the young and the not so young, the teens, all those people in here today, I submit to you that your parents are not doing everything right. They are trapped a little bit. They've got this baggage from the way they were raised, and you've got a little bit of baggage, but it's up to each one of us and each family unit to make generational improvements. We cannot just say, "Oh, well, you know, that's the way it is. And in the Iams family, we do this." That's not good enough. And you might have disagreements and bickering from time to time, and you have to learn to work through that. And you have to learn to cohabitate in peace. I remember as a child, we'd go to church services and everything would be hunky-dory. And you'd go out to the car and the doors would shut and the griping would begin. And it's like, "Oh, why is this happening?" And I'm like, "I am not going to do that to my kids." It's like, guess what? So we have to learn to cohabitate in peace. It's not about just head knowledge. It's about practicing and following through with what we've learned. It's a process, and we come back week after week. All right, we're going to get it right. When we leave church this time, no bickering. My father took the challenge that God gave him. He didn't do it perfectly. I'm not doing it perfectly, but he figuratively handed me the baton and said, "Your turn. You didn't like the way I raised you, then you see if you can do it better." In Matthew 25, verse 14, is the parable of the kingdom of heaven, like a man traveling to a far country. Not going to read through all of this. He called his servants. He delivered to 1 5, 1 2, 1 1. And he went away for a journey. Anybody seen Christ lately? He's been gone for quite a while. What are you doing with your 5 talents or your 2 talents or your 1 talent? Are you improving? Are you making that 5 talents? Are you growing that to another 5? Are you taking what your parents delivered to you and making it better and passing it on in a better light and a better manner? He went on a far country, but when he came back, he said, what have you done with it? In verse 16, and he who had received 5 talents went and traded with them and made another 5 talents. He did well with what he was given. And likewise, he who had received 2 gained 2 more also. And verse 21, to the one who had gained 5 talents, he said, well done, you good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. I was reading this and I was thinking, I wonder if we've been reading this wrong all these years. And I haven't quite got this straight in my head, but what if these things that you're ruling over was your family as they grow and they, you know, move across the earth and they are into the different cities? And what if we were like ruling our own kids? And wouldn't that be something? I better be a good dad so that the kids would want to be around me forever. I'm going to skip the guy who had the 1 talent because I disagree with everything he did. And I don't think any of you should try to emulate him either. Verse 23, he says, well done, you good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things and will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. So we want to be there and we want to help God the Father and Jesus Christ rule this earth. We've been waiting on this for years. It's like, come on, let's get on with this. You know, thy kingdom come. Let's get on with it. And yet we're still here and we still have this challenge. So my challenge to you is not based on what my father did, or my challenge to me is not based on what my father did. My challenge is to take with what I have. If God gave me 2 talents, then I have to go and do everything I can with those 2 talents. And if he gave you 5, then you better make good use of those. My kids' challenge is going to be to take I think they've been given 15, but they have to take and make good use of what they've been given. It's like a relay race, but you can only run your segment. You can't live your kid's life and you can't change your parents' life. It's the same challenge whether you're a second generation or first generation or third or fourth or fifth. We all have to run our race. We all have to apply God's law. And we all have to make the same percentage. I think about this in terms like, well, it's like interest rate. You know, if you get really good interest, if you put in so much, then you get so much more out. Well, my dad made incredible improvements over what he started with. And I don't really feel like I've made the same percentage of improvement that he did. Okay, maybe I'm not working as hard. Maybe, I don't know. I have to do the best I can with what I have, with what I've been given. So I have to, am I a better parent than my dad was? Are you a better parent? Are you a better grandparent? Are you setting a better example than those before you set? We have to take what we have been given and improve on it. And at the same time, it's not about comparing ourselves among ourselves, because it won't matter how good a job we do. We're not going to be perfect. Jesus Christ set the perfect example, and we need to be. It's all about coming to the stature of the fullness of Christ, not trying to make the Imes family look so good. So we've got to learn it in order to be able to teach it. And if you don't know it, if you don't know your Bibles, if you're not living God's way now, how are you going to recognize it if you're not living it? So we have to strive to practice what we preach. Recently, in my office, one of our doorknobs broke. Now, this doorknob happens to be the doorknob to the bathroom in the back hall. I go through this door like 50 times a day, usually at half a running speed. Maybe that's why the door broke. But this door latch, this doorknob is the kind, for historically, it's been the kind of door where I can go through it one way, but it can be locked on the other side. So whether it's locked or not locked, I can still open it and dart out the door. I might not be able to get back in, but I can just hit that door, bang, and out the door I go. So when I change the lock, the new doorknob has to be unlocked. I have to turn the little gidget in order to open the door. How many times do you think I've face planted on that door because I have not unlocked the door from the inside? I know, I put the lock on there, I know how to go through that door. I know I have to unlatch it before I can open it. It works very well. It's made well. I just unlatch it, go through the door. Face plant, face plant, face plant. Notice the other day I was came to the door and I went, oh, I'll unlatch it. Oh, it works so much better. You know, this is the way I see it in my family. I see myself doing this. It's like, I know what I'm supposed to say. I know what I'm supposed to do. And the kids will do something. Bang! Face plant. All right. All right, kids. It's not the way to do it. I got to do it right. I got to do it over. Okay. But we end up just shooting from the hip so many times. Maybe my family's different, but we end up with these habits and we know the right way to do things and we still face plant on the door. And we have to work to not do that. Today, the stakes are higher than they've ever been for potential disaster. And, you know, again, the Satan being the prince of the power of the air, he is a pain. The stakes are high. The stakes are high for us. The stakes are high for our kids. You know, 50 years ago, kids would go sneak out behind the barn and smoke a cigarette. Today, there is no barn, and the ways of ruining your life are just multitudinous. And we have to remember, our kids have to remember, each of us has to remember, you can't do that. You're going to ruin your life. You're going to create baggage. You're going to mess your life up, and then you're going to have to live with it. And we don't want to live with the baggage. We want to, it's like, we want a nice, clean, I'm a paint guy. It's like, don't touch the paint. Don't scratch the paint. Don't mess up what God has given you. Because once you mess it up, you can't ever fix it like it used to be. And we just want to take care of our families. We want to be careful that we don't set the wrong example for our kids, that we don't teach them things that have no business being taught. So we, like I said, the stakes are high and we need to pass on godly characteristics, not the worldly characteristics that come so easy. So none of us does it perfectly. And unfortunately, our kids do emulate the negative things sometimes as well as the positive things. Recently, and it wasn't the most recent United News, but the one before that, Bob Berndt wrote an article, lead story on the front page. He said, in part in that article, he said, it seems we humans are not good at passing on hard lessons of life to the next generation. Generation after generation has to learn all over again the great lessons of life and the values that promote happiness, contentment, and peace. It's very difficult to pass a lesson on. I personally can learn the lesson. Don't face plant on the bathroom door. But I can't teach that. I can tell my son or daughters, don't do this, but they have to take it personally. They have to make the generational improvement that again, whatever situation I've handed them, they have to take it and improve on it. During the millennial time, it will never have been easier to create good families, decent families, because Satan the devil will be out of the picture. Yes, they'll still have to fight themselves. They'll still have to fight Satan. There may be some peer pressure that may not go over so well. But when Satan is released, people do the unthinkable and they say, oh, we want to go back into that garbage. I don't know. Will there be libraries that somebody's maybe telling them what it used to be? But, you know, it's almost like the Genesis 3 scene over again. Satan's released and then he starts planning these thoughts and people go, oh, I've never thought of it that way before. So we have to develop character in our families. Again, we have to pass it down. And it's not just head knowledge. It's not saying, like when I was a kid, we'd say, yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. It's like, oh, you have to say yes, ma'am, yes, sir, or else you're in trouble. Well, what's in your heart? Do you mean yes, ma'am, yes, sir? Or do you just say it because you had to? And so these people might be in a millennium, they might be obeying because they have to, because they get tired of getting slapped around saying, no, this is the way you walk in it. So, again, we have to do our part. We have to pass it down the right way. So not everybody's going to flock to Satan. Hopefully people will learn the lessons they need to. So if each generation can make improvements on how they are raised, by the end of the millennium, we should have a pretty decent group of people and some pretty decent families. They still have to make hard decisions. They're still going to make mistakes. They still have to have character. But they have opportunity. They have the best chance in history to be able to improve and make those improvements. I wanted to read a couple quotes from our, I think our teens at this point in time in the history of the church, I think we have an incredible group of teens. It's really, we were at a group outing the other, or teen activity the other night, and it's just really heartwarming to be in a group of teens and they're laughing and carrying on and talking, and they're not being sneaky and, you know, the smell of cigarettes and you know, there are no bottles around. I mean, it's just good, clean fun. And you've gone to camps and you've had opportunities and you've made good with those opportunities. And I congratulate you on those. You've got to take those things and use them and pass them on. You've got to hand, you know, the baton's being handed to you. You're going to have to run with it. But I've just been impressed with some of the good things that have come out of the camps. I wanted to read a few of the quotes that came out of the Northwest camp. It says, the question is, what spiritual lesson did you learn at camp this year? And the quote is, how important a life of character could improve enjoying life. Another one is, I learned to be a servant leader and to pray more every day. Keep God involved in my life. Folks, I want to tell you, this was not my focus when I was a teenager. I did not care about praying every day and keeping God involved in my life. I was trying to dodge the wrath of my father. And it's a different group of people now. And I'm just grateful for that. Another one writes, what did you learn at camp this year? To respect women, trust God, build character. It's just, again, heartwarming to see what our kids are learning and what they're going through and how they're being prepared to raise the next generation. So, as called out ones, we have the opportunity to live now and to pass on positive qualities, things we've learned. Unfortunately, we're going to pass on some negatives. The kids, the next generation is going to have to work those out. But we have God, we have the Bible, we have opportunities, we have the people that are trying to mentor these kids. We have many, many opportunities to do it right. And brethren, it's up to us, each and every one, to make generational improvements both today and to help those in the millennium.